This podcast is for general information purposes only and is not advice. Outside of the United States, this episode is intended for investment professional use only, not for further distribution. Please listen to the end for complete information.
Even as you project out to 2050, and even if you take very aggressive assumptions about a transition or an evolution where you move more, you know, more electrification and moving more nuclear, the timescale to make the change and the size of what needs to change means that you're going to continue to need oil and gas, and it will probably be providing, you know, still around 50% of the world's energy mix even out in 2050.
Welcome back to The Angle from T. Rowe Price, a podcast for curious investors. I'm Eric Weil, Head of Global Investments and Chief Investment Officer here at T. Rowe Price Associates. In this episode, I'm excited to welcome Darren Woods, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of ExxonMobil, one of the world's largest publicly traded energy providers and chemical manufacturers. Darren's time with ExxonMobil spans over three decades. He became CEO in January of 2017, and his commitment to balancing economic growth with environmental stewardship has been a hallmark of his tenure. Welcome to Baltimore, Darren. Thank you for being on The Angle.
That's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. Looking forward to it.
ExxonMobil is one of these companies that I think everybody thinks they know and understand, right? Oh, it's really big. You've got 60,000 employees, $350 billion in revenue. I know what ExxonMobil is. One of the things that I think people don't recognize is 100 million barrels per day produced in the world. You guys are what, 4%?
All right, that's right. Yeah,
so
exactly.
What do you think are the biggest misconceptions about ExxonMobil?
Well, I think for a long time we've let external publications define who we are, or at least talk about who we are. And we've been more recently really trying to make sure that we're telling our own story, being faithful to who we are. The first job I had with the company, my supervisor said, let me give you some advice. And this was like day two or something. And he said, if you're ever doing something you'd be embarrassed for your mother to read about on the front page of the paper, stop doing it. The other thing he said to me was, he said, you got to get up every morning and look yourself in the mirror, make sure you like what you see. Okay, those are very simple things, but they've stuck with me for 33 years. And, you know, this philosophy that we have as a company, and one that I've grown up with for the last 33 years, is do the right thing in the right way. And so that, for all of my career, there's not been a decision that I've made that, there have been hard ones for sure, but one that I haven't felt like was the right decision for the company, for the best interest of our shareholders, our employees, the communities that we've been operating in. And so I think that is, if there's anything that summarized what we try to do as a company, is the right thing in the right way. We hold ourselves to a very high standard. Integrity is a really important value for us. Intellectual integrity is an important value for us. Courage is one of our values. We believe, you know, you have to stick to what you believe is right and be willing to fight for it and take the blows that come with that.
Yeah.
Resilience is another one of our values. You know, this industry and the jobs that we have to do, the challenges that we face will not be easy. You will get knocked down. No shame in being knocked down. There's a lot of shame in not getting back up again. And so fight your way back up and just keep after it. And I think that's who we are as a company. That's why I joined 33 years ago. Never thought I'd be here this long on. I can still remember when the HR manager was talking, when I first joined the company, was talking about our long-term benefits and all this. And I can still remember telling her, you know, you're talking like we just got married. As far as I'm concerned, this is a date. And I really felt like that. I don't know when I realized I was actually married, but for a long time I thought we were dating, but it just worked out that I'd found, you know, I guess my life mate with respect to the company. It's been a great ride.
Let's talk a little bit about the industry. You know, I had Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, on last month, and we were talking about AI, and he mentioned, and we talked a lot about the fact that the biggest limiter right now in AI is actually power generation, and the almost what seems insatiable demand from that one area of the market for energy. You guys put out a really interesting report, the 2050 Global Outlook piece. Mm-hmm. There was a stat in there that I was fascinated by, which was basically, I won't misquote it, I hope, even if every new car sold in the world in 2035 were electric, 2050 would still need 85 million barrels per day,
right?
Based on your estimate. So, given all of that, how are you all investing today to meet these growing needs and at best flat, but likely growing needs?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's a constant challenge, and what often gets overlooked, primarily because it's people who aren't in the industry and dealing with the daily challenge, you know, don't have a perspective on it, and frankly, the industry's done such a good job that they don't have to worry about it, is we're in a depletion business. So every barrel you produce is a barrel less available. It's not like general manufacturing where you build a facility and the facility's there for the next 100 years and you just got to keep putting feedstock through it. In this case, you got to keep finding, you know, a replacement. So it's a little bit like having a bottle of water and you're drinking the water out of it. Eventually the bottle goes empty and you better have another bottle sitting around somewhere for the next drink. So that's the big challenge with the unconventional shale play that's come into the energy mix and the crude supply and gas supply for that matter. That has a much faster decline rate, and it's gotten to be such a large part of the global energy supply that it's actually changed the decline rate, the depletion rate of the global crude supply. So today, if no other investments were going into the industry to produce more crude, we estimate that the decline rate is 15 million barrels a day. And so if you know, people talk about stop investing, leaving it in the ground, yeah, the world would very quickly run out of crude oil with that kind of, give me 100 million barrels a day, you're losing 15 million barrels a day. It doesn't take you long as you drop off every year, 15% decline, that you quickly run out of resource. If you start making incremental investments, so no new exploration, but just start to offset some of the decline by some of the things you can do on the periphery of what's already operating, you can slow that down to about 4%, but it's still a significant decline rate. So it is a huge challenge for the industry to not only support growth, but just to offset the depletion. And so everyone in the industry, including ourselves, are constantly looking for the next barrel, for squeezing more out of what we have, finding new technologies to become more productive. It is a nonstop challenge. And so we've always, from the very beginning, and we were doing a lot of this in the 2018, 2019 timeframe, getting a lot of criticism for, because at that time, there was a view that you should stop because the energy transition was coming and these investments weren't going to, you know, we're going to get stranded. We never believed that because of this depletion dynamic, and worked very hard to invest and bring those barrels on. And I'm glad we did, because we now have that resource to take advantage of. Yep. But it is a huge, there's a technology play that we're spending a lot of time investing in to make sure that we're finding ways to better extract, more effectively find, more effectively squeeze the resources out of what we do find, so that we keep filling that hole. But it is a significant challenge.
So one of the, you know, major projects that you guys have is in Guyana.
Yeah.
And our analyst Priyal was out there. And the images that I've seen, the description that she gives, just an amazing amount of just material, and the scope of that is huge. If we think 20 years into the future, do you envision the industry starting projects like that new, or do you think we've moved to a different technology or a different way of powering our world?
No, I think you're going to continue to need, you know, oil and gas, even as you project out into 2050, and even if you take very aggressive assumptions about a transition or an evolution where you move more, you know, more electrification and moving more nuclear, the time scale to make the change and the size of what needs to change means that you're going to continue to need oil and gas, and it will probably be providing, you know, still around 50% of the world's energy mix even out in 2050, even with aggressive assumptions about that, just because the system is so large that to change it, and if you go back in time, there's been no energy transition that's happened quickly.
Right.
The bigger challenge, even with that, the size and the time it's going to take, is the affordability issue. And I think it's easy for many of us in, you know, very developed nations, very prosperous nations, to talk about making a change and paying for that. You know, there are 4 billion people around the planet that are living in absolute energy poverty that I think desperately strive for and frankly deserve a much higher standard of living, which will require more energy.
Right.
There are economies around the world that have the need to grow and the potential to significantly grow. That's going to require more energy. And so we can look at some of the more developed nations who can start to make progress and pay for that. But there's a whole chunk of the world, and it's a big one, that's still very early on that curve, and they're going to need to come up, and they're going to need affordable, reliable energy. And today, we don't have good options other than the system that we have. I'm still optimistic, though, because we do believe strongly that the world needs to find ways to reduce emissions. You know, one of my concerns or complaints has been that we've lost sight of the objective statement. Mm-hmm. That through the debate, and I think a lot of the ideology that's been out there for many years, is they've turned the need to reduce emissions into the need to reduce oil and gas.
Right.
And I mean, and I don't think oil and gas will ever go away, because it's a critical component to chemical products. And chemical products that we make and others make form the foundation of modern living today. I don't think people realize that how much hydrogen and carbon molecules go into day-to-day life, and the appliances, the tools, the clothing, and just about everything that they use,
the technology
every day, everything.
Use,
it's buried in that. It's an inherent part of that, and so it's going to be around for a long, long time. What we've got to focus on is less combustion. Mm-hmm. Of hydrogen and carbon molecules, and when we do have to combust them, find ways to deal with the emissions. And I think if we get a more sophisticated or better objective statement and get focused back on the real objective, is let's deal with the emissions, we can make a lot faster progress at a lot lower cost.
One of the things that I've always appreciated about you, Darren, is you tell it like it is, and you've been very clear, like, climate change is real. You've acknowledged it many times, but you've also said we need pragmatic solutions, which is
absolutely
sort of what you're referring to
here.
In your mind, what are the foundations of those pragmatic solutions that will help us?
And
obviously capture is probably part of it, but I'm curious.
No, I think, you know, I think if I go back in time, probably the biggest mistake I'll say society made is we jumped to an answer, a solution set that I think was defined by, frankly, a very narrow set of ideologues who did not have any practical experience in certainly the energy system, let alone probably manufacturing or, you know, running and making products that society needs. And for a long time, I think the mistake we made was we criticized a lot of the policies that were coming out and the approach without offering a thoughtful alternative. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we challenged ourselves was, okay, we think what's happening and some of the approaches are flawed, what would we do? If at the end of the day they gave us the keys and said, you guys figure this out, what would be your approach? And so we challenged ourselves to think through what would we recommend based on what we know. I'm not so naive to think that I can figure out a solution for the whole, but we do understand our industry and the sector that we operate in. So for our sector, what do we think would be a reasonable solution that's consistent with macroeconomic policies, mm-hmm. that doesn't impede economic growth, it doesn't impinge people's lifestyle or standard of living? And what we started with is, first and foremost, we need a carbon accounting system. The thing that blows me away is that we have, and the world talks about getting to net zero and eliminating all the carbon emissions, but we have no system for accounting for carbon emissions. And so I wonder, how do you eliminate something that you're not accounting for?
Yeah.
I don't know of any example that anyone can point to that's ever happened.
You manage what you measure, and if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. That's basic principle.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think even measuring could be hard, but at least you should account for it, so that at the end of the day, you have a system that when you add it all up, it's equal to the total emissions of the planet. So now mm-hmm. I can begin to characterize where are the emissions coming from in my society and the products. So that's job one, and the point I make with a number of constituencies I talk to, whether you think you need that right now or not, I think ultimately everyone can agree that if you're ever going to get down to zero, you're going to have it at some state. So let's start working on it now. Because mm-hmm. I think if you had a carbon accounting system, we could start to move down the emissions reduction path much quicker. Because the second step is, once you know how to properly account for them and you've agreed that around the planet, you can calculate the carbon intensity of every product and service that society uses. Once you can calculate the carbon intensity of a product, you can put a spec on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so our approach would be, let's go do carbon accounting, let's start calculating carbon intensity, and I don't, you know, again, that's a hard problem to solve, but we can make some simplifying assumptions. The important thing is we do it in a consistent way that reflects some level of realism and reality, and then put a carbon intensity specification. All the government needs to do is specify the carbon intensity and then get out of the way,
mm-hmm.
and let industry figure out how to meet that carbon intensity specification. And that then starts to bring in the market forces. It as a producer, and I would offer up, do it for gasoline, do it for diesel. So take the transportation pool in the U.S., put a carbon intensity specification on it, and then let us figure out how we meet that carbon intensity mm-hmm. specification. That will drive me to find ways to do it at a lower and lower cost, to get a competitive advantage. If I find that advantage accrues to me, because yep. the marginal supplier with the highest cost will set the price in the marketplace. Yep. That gives me an advantage. It incentivizes me to invest in technology. It gets the government out of picking winners and losers. It gets the government out of collecting revenues and redistributing them and paying subsidies. And then you pick the core products that are driving most of the emissions. You don't have to do it economy-wide, but you could, you know, 20% of it's causing 80% of the problem. Yeah. Go focus on those 20% and work like crazy on those. And then, you know, if you're in the camp that we'll transition to something brand new, I'm okay with that as well. It gives us the time to do that and the natural time horizon it's going to take. And so I think we've done the math on that. You could decarbonize. Think about decarbonizing the transportation system today and all the cars and trucks that are out there today. You can incrementally reduce the carbon at a small amount of carbon emissions from all that across such a large volume that the cost would be small, the volume impact would be big, and the time scale to achieve it much, much faster than EVs. And so mm-hmm. we could start to affect real emissions reductions at a much lower cost, much faster.
So at the start of that, the accounting that we need, is that something that comes from the industry, from the government?
I think it needs to be.
How do you do it globally?
Right. I think that needs to be a broad. In fact, I've been having conversations, talked to a group at the World Economic Forum. There are other. We've got a coalition that we're talking about forming. That you need a cross-industry group. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's our industry that does that. I don't think it's our company that does that. We can contribute, can bring some thinking, but I think you need a much, you know, academics need to be involved, the right kind of academics, some governments, but ultimately, you know, it's like calories on food.
Right.
Somehow the world figured out how to calculate calories consistently all around the planet, and we kind of stick to that. There is a mechanism, and we've got accounting standards today. Now, financial accounting is very different than the kind of accounting that I'm talking about, but the fact that the world has arrived at standards and approaches that everyone conforms with demonstrates to me that this can happen. We just got to go put the right body together to go make that work.
Carbon capture is an area you guys have invested mm-hmm. a lot in mm-hmm. over time, but I think you've been pretty clear that it's really not economically feasible in a lot of ways in its current form. Is there a path where that becomes some part of the solution or a bigger part of the solution?
So, you know, our approach in that space, you know, for a long time, a lot of pressure the company came under to invest in wind and solar, because this idea that you're an energy company and therefore as an energy company and one that's where the world's worried about emissions, you should move to electrons. And the point I kept making is we don't know anything about wind and solar. We're a molecule company. We're not an electron company. So let's focus on how we can address the societal need, which is emissions reductions, using our capabilities in molecules. That's, I'd say, the simple formula that mm-hmm. we landed on. And it sounds rather simplistic, and I think somewhat intuitive, is do the things you know how to do. So in the molecule space, what can we do? What makes sense? Carbon capture and storage is a very good fit with our core capabilities. Biofuels is another area. We've got mm-hmm. refineries all around the world. We can process biofeeds and produce fuels that have lower emissions profiles. It's another area. And then we're looking at low carbon hydrogen. So those were the areas that we felt like lent themselves to our molecule technology and where we could bring something to bear. Mm-hmm. So our view is carbon capture is going to be needed. It's going to be a competitive technology. We're doing a lot of work on the technology to bring the cost down because we have to do that. But typically when you don't need it and you don't have to bring cost down, you won't.
Right.
So that's the work that I think has to happen. I'm not sure when when that will take off, or if society will ever truly commit to the ambition of reducing the emissions. But when they do, and we think they should, we're going to be in a position to help provide that. And actually, with respect to your AI question and Jensen, we now have, because of those investments that we've made, the opportunity to offer low-carbon data centers. Mm-hmm. And in the time frame that many of the tech companies are talking about needing that low-carbon data centers, we're uniquely positioned to provide that.
Let's pivot a little bit to your personal journey as a leader. You know, you started off, as you said, you know, thinking you were dating, and here you're well married to ExxonMobil at this point. Began as an electrical engineer. How do you think that training and that background sort of formed your decision-making strategies and led you to be CEO?
Well, when I was an undergraduate, I wanted to be a PhD. I wanted to go into the electromagnetic field, and I wanted to do R&D. And my senior year in college, I did some research that, I guess for lack of a better term, burned me out on that whole idea. And so I decided to go work for a little while with the intention of going back to school. And I got out and got a job as a technical consultant advising the Air Force on a missile system. And it became very clear to me early on that you could be the best engineer in the world, but if you didn't know how to make money or to get funding, that you couldn't fund the ideas, and it wasn't, you know, you only could only advance stuff that you could afford to advance. And so I felt like I didn't have a good understanding of how to make money or the whole financial world or business. And so after 3 years working as this technical advisor, I went back and got an MBA. And so I think, you know, my foundation as an engineer, you know, that helped me throughout my career, because we deal with a lot of engineering problems. And while I think honestly say I've never done a day's work of electrical engineering, the principles that you learn and how you think about engineering and the problem solving skills and how you take these large ambiguous problems and break them down into pieces that you can think about and solve, and the logical approach associated with doing that, that's all been absolutely critical throughout my career, and even today continue to use those core the foundations of how you think about solving engineering problems. And then, of course, I do not discount the education I got within my company and mm-hmm. within ExxonMobil. I'm very proud of the fact that we bring in people early in their careers, usually right out of school, and we invest a lot of time to develop them. And I spend today and throughout my career, I've always had everyone who joins the company and supervises or manages somebody, you're told your job is to develop the next CEO. You don't know who it's going to be, but that's your job. Find the next CEO, develop people to their full potential. And so from the very early days in my career, always looking at how do you help people reach their full potential. Your potential can change with time, right, and your performance. It can go up because you've hit a growth spurt, so to speak, or you got into a groove, you began to, and so we've seen people just surprise us and do things that we didn't anticipate. We've seen other people reach a level where that what's required to advance the next wasn't something that they wanted to invest in, and so that was potential. So it's a very dynamic thing, but I would say less transparent in the past than we are today, and still not as transparent as I hope we'll get to as we develop.
Learning from mistakes is an important part of being a good investor and having sort of the intellectual honesty to critique what you got wrong, own it, and then try to move on from it. What's a mistake you've made and a lesson you've learned from it through some point in your career, Darren?
You know, it's a funny thing. So we are our company, we're very critical of ourselves, and so we're constantly looking for where we could have done better. We do a lot of after-action things, and I think most people who grew up in the country will tell you we tend to focus on what we could do better rather than what we did well. Again, that's something that we want to try to strike a little better balance on. I think, you know, probably one of the very early mistakes that I made in my career that really shaped me for a long time to come. I was very early in a refinery. I was working in a plant. I had a supervisor who recognized I came in as an MBA, so didn't have the same development through operations that many of our young engineers that come in get to start at a plant, work their way up, and then get into more management jobs. I kind of came in at management levels mm-hmm. and didn't have the benefit of the experience of being in the plant and being in operations. I had a supervisor when I was over in the UK that said, you need that experience, and so dropped me into one of those roles, which was a step down from a hierarchical standpoint, but a really critical development step that I needed. In that role, we had some unit issues that I thought I understood what we needed to do, and the more experienced manufacturer around me thought there was a different approach that we needed to take. And so I didn't necessarily agree with it, but I deferred to their experience and judgment. And then in hindsight, it turned out I was right and they were wrong. But we only learned that by doing it their way and then having to go back. And at the time, it probably cost us several millions of dollars with lost throughput and what have you. And for me, I can still remember that whatever that number was, it's in the scheme of what I think about today, it's a very small number, but at the time it seemed enormous. And it bothered me. I can't tell you how long that ate at me, that the regret mm-hmm. that you knew what the right thing to do was and you were too afraid to stand up and fight for yeah. it. I said, I don't want to experience this ever again. And so from that point forward, I've lived up to that commitment, and I've always made sure that everybody understands my point of view, whether you agree with it or not. And I try to make it as a compelling argument as possible. And I think that has, most people that work with me through the career, I think they would recognize that how I've behaved since then, but it came from a very hard lesson that I taught myself, and I just didn't want to feel that way ever again, and it's served me well so far.
It's really interesting. One of the mistakes we see young analysts make is they try to anticipate what they think the portfolio manager wants the answer to be on the stock, as opposed to having their own conviction and then staying with it, even if their research has led them a certain place. It's very similar to what you experienced there. Having, you know, strong views, we like to say strong views held lightly, right? Yeah. So have those strong views, but be willing to think about new information that might change them.
Yeah, we talk about courage of conviction. You know, you've got to have courage of conviction. And so you need to be convinced of something, obviously, but then have the courage to represent it.
So what do you want your legacy to be at ExxonMobil? You're far away from having to like put that in stone, but it's important to think about those things before you get to the end.
You know, I don't think of a legacy maybe in the way others do. I mean, I came to this job in an unusual way. I never aspired to. It wasn't something that I wasn't ambitious in that respect. You know, my love of the company and the career I've had with this company is just getting lots of hard problems to solve and being recognized for that and giving me another hard problem to solve. I got to travel all around the world and had some great experiences. And so I've always enjoyed, and so I didn't come to this job with this ambition to have it. I came to the job, and when I took it was, if you need me to, I will. And so I would just say my ambition is to basically realize the full potential of this company. I came into the job with the weight of the what I would say is the legacy that I inherited, the mm-hmm. you know, the 100 plus years of you know, employees and leaders and, you know, this company that I was now responsible for. I just felt a huge sense of responsibility to deliver and to make the best out of the thing that was given to me to be responsible for and to leave something better for the next person. I think, you know, every job I ever have at the company, you go into with the mindset of how do I make this better for the person who's going to take it from me? And I would say I've taken this job with that same mindset. How do I make this better for the person who comes in behind me? There will always be an opportunity to make it better. So my view is, you know, this, and I've never criticized the things left for me to pick up in jobs I've inherited over the years, because I don't know what they started with.
Right.
And everybody starts with something, and your job is to make it better and leave it for the next person to carry on. So I think that's, you know, my, I really want to leave a company a better place. I want to leave a company that the people who work for it are proud.
These are obviously stressful times and stressful role. What do you do to try to ease some of that stress when you're not in the office? Any go-to ways to unwind?
I like to get away solitude and family. So I have, I'm lucky enough to, we have some property in the hill country of Texas, which we can escape to on some long weekends. And it's out in the middle of nowhere and very few people and a lot of nature, very, very pretty place. And so the family often congregates there and just quiet time alone. We've got a place on a lake up north that we get to on occasion and spend there. So it's really around getting out of the flow, quiet time. It's really around nature and family. It's kind of what I like to do. And yeah.
Turn your phone off when you're out there?
The phone always stays on. I think, you know, most people don't want to call me, generally found, but I'm always available. But I think we all respect the fact that every one of the employees that we have, all our folks work really hard. And, you know, we recognize that when you're off work, I certainly feel this way. I try not to send emails, you know, significantly out of hours. I try not to send emails over the week. I just don't want to have people feel like they need to be responding on the instant. So I try to be very respectful of other people's time. Oftentimes the job doesn't allow that, but I am conscious of that. And I think everybody else is conscious. They don't, you know, if there's something that can wait to talk about or email or what have you, the week, people will wait until after the weekend. I think that's a good practice. And then the things that do come in, you give it your attention. But
well, speaking of being respectful of time, I've already taken more of yours than I said I would. So let's end it there. But, you know, Darren, thank you so much. This has been great. Really interesting conversation. Really appreciate you spending the time with us.
Thank you. Thanks for the time. Enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thanks.
Again, I'm Eric Vile. Thank you for listening to The Angle. We look forward to your company on future episodes. You can find more information about this and other topics on our website. Please rate and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The Angle. Better questions, better insights, only from T. Rowe Price.
This podcast episode was recorded in June of 2025 and is for general information and educational purposes only. Outside the United States, it is for investment professional use only. It is not intended to be used by persons in jurisdictions which prohibit or restrict distribution of the material herein. The podcast does not give advice or recommendation of any nature or constitute an offer or solicitation to sell or buy any security in any jurisdiction. Prospective investors should seek independent legal, financial, and tax advice before making any investment decision. Past performance is not a reliable indicator of future performance. All investments are subject to risk, including the possible loss of principal. Discussions relating to specific securities are informational only, are not recommendations, and may or may not have been held in any T. Rowe Price portfolio. There should be no assumption that the securities were or will be profitable. T. Rowe Price is not affiliated with any companies discussed. Some T. Rowe Price portfolios are invested in ExxonMobil Corporation. The views contained herein are of the speakers as of the date of the recording and are subject to change without notice. These views may differ from those of other T. Rowe Price associates and or affiliates. Information is from sources deemed reliable but not guaranteed. Please visit https://www.troweprice.com/en/uk/insights/the-long-view-exxonmobil for full global issuer disclosures. This podcast is copyright by T. Rowe Price 2025.